One of our reporters recently tagged along on the job with Kansas City's illegal dumping expert.
So it looks like somebody pulled up and drug something right through here. I've had cases like this where you can see something was clearly drug across the sidewalk and went right to a neighbor's house. Pretty incriminating stuff.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to meet Alan Ashurst, Kansas City's illegal dumping expert. When people toss things where they don't belong, Alan is on the case, sleuthing it out. Not bad for a government job, right, Alan?
It's fantastic. It's fantastic.
How long have you done this job?
Well, I've been in the illegal dumping investigation for about 5 years now, but prior to that, I spent 2 years doing the codes enforcement stuff, which is the property violation. Still no lack of... Lack of garbage at that point either.
So what is it that you love about the job?
It's rewarding. You know, when you start talking about, you know, our neighborhoods and our community, it's, you know, garbage is on the front line of the quality of life of these folks.
Explain that.
Well, you know, if you're home and, you know, everybody wants to be in their home, it's their safe place. But if you don't feel safe, you're not safe is basically the fact of the matter. And wherever there's garbage and blight and stuff like that is where people, you know, you start attracting vermin. You know, any kind of animals start digging through the trash. It starts just attracting criminals. Homeless like to go through the trash. Any number of things. But when you start catching people who have maliciously taken their garbage and thrown it out on the street in our community, that's just it's the ultimate lack of respect. And catching them and finding them and getting them into court is extremely rewarding.
What is your sense of some of the motivations people have for maliciously dumping their trash, as you put
it? It's lazy. It's lazy and lack of respect because there's no need for it. This isn't one of those things that people do in desperate times. You know, this desperate times, desperate measures kind of deal. This is not one of them. This is, I forgot to put my trash out. Now I've got two extra bags. How do I get rid of it? You know, everything that we can, you know, everything that people dump, you can get rid of for free. You can get rid of your bulk items. You just have to be patient enough and make the call. The city will come get it for free. We take 80 pounds a week off your curb. You can recycle as much as you want. The leaf and brush drop-offs at Missouri Organic are free on Saturdays.
You're very passionate about
this. I'm extremely passionate about it. You betcha. Folks don't deserve to live amongst people's garbage just because they don't have a whole lot of money. It's ridiculous. You can walk up and down these streets and see who has some self-respect and who doesn't.
So there's a discrepancy that you would note just objectively between the income level of a neighborhood and the amount of trash that's out on the street?
I wouldn't. No, I mean, I don't think that, you know, the guy who takes a little pride in his home, and you can tell by looking at it, doesn't have any more money than anybody else. He just doesn't want to live with garbage all over his property. And case in point, he didn't want to live next to folks that have garbage all over their property as well, which is where I come in and, you know, the rest of the code enforcement officers. We're working for those folks that want to be an active part of our community.
The story that's put you in the public eye was a story of a mailman caught on tape chucking people's mail, which seemed really weird to me, but did it seem weird to you?
Weird... No. Surprised? No. I mean, it was the first time I'd seen something like that. You know, I don't know. I think I've probably gotten to the point where very little actually surprises me anymore. But it was certainly a case that I knew was going to be different. And I knew it was going to be bigger than what I could handle. You know, he's going to get enforcement from me, that's for sure. But it was bigger and above that. But weird, I wouldn't say it was weird. People are going to do what people are going to do.
When you say that very little surprises you anymore, can you tell me about something that has still managed to surprise you? That something that you have seen tossed on the side of the road, or just a story like when you figured out what had happened, you were like, what?
Well, I'd have to go back a couple years.
Please do.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. We had a city project. We were going to tear up 8th and Paseo, all the sidewalks, and have it all redone. The city had hired a contractor. Well, and I was out off of the Dunbar area. We'd actually Sam and I had gone through. And I was looking around, and I didn't really notice anything out of the ordinary until I looked to my left, and I noticed thousands upon thousands of pounds of concrete. Well, when I had checked the camera, it was the contractor that the city had hired to do the city work that had torn up all that sidewalk and illegally dumped it in the Dunbar area. So that was pretty surprising.
Your passion for the cleanliness of neighborhoods, for the safety of neighborhoods, and your sort of indignation that is just radiating from you toward people who violate that by dumping things illegally. Where does it come from? Can you trace it back to a moment where this became a passion for you?
You know, that's a fantastic question. You know, I really can't. When I first started in codes enforcement, and I saw that there was a very real opportunity, if you applied yourself accordingly, to really make a difference in these neighborhoods. And I saw that, and I took advantage of it, and I started, it kind of went back to my Marine Corps days. You know, if I can't serve my country anymore, you know, let's serve the city, and let's make a difference in these folks' lives, and I can make a difference. And, you know, I know some of these folks that live out here, and they don't deserve to live next to some of these folks and live in people's garbage.
It just kind of
happened one day. I was like, wow, I'm the kind of guy that if I don't like something, I'm not going to do it. That's why I wasn't good in school.
It's interesting, though, to me, because there are people, you see yourself as going into neighborhoods and helping people, but I'm sure there are people who are afraid of codes enforcement and feel perhaps like, well, I would invest in my property if I had the money, or I would invest in taking this kind of care if I had the spare time, and just feel a little like maybe it isn't their perception that you're trying to help them.
Sure. Understood. And that's an extremely political question.
Is
I like
it?
Your style. So, well, yeah. Because, I mean, you've got a number of things to consider here. First and foremost, a lot of people have jobs because of addiction and mental health. Okay, so a lot of what we deal with out there in these neighborhoods and a lot of these conditions are based off of just that, addiction and mental health. Your properties go south on you. You come out of a, you know, a drug addiction bender and things have just gotten out of control and now you're beyond being able to really do something. We know that hoarding is a mental health addiction, and there are, you know, ways to help folks like that. But if you're somebody who is, you know, truly needing help, you're looking for a hand up, and you need to get back on track with property violations, the city has municipal court funds to help those folks. But those are the folks who want to be, you know, they're not addicts. They're not, you know, mental health. That's something that's beyond the city. Those are third parties that can help that kind of stuff. But if you are truly somebody who's interested in getting back in compliance with what the city expects of you and your property, the help is there, but you have to want it. So though you may not be all that interested in somebody coming out and inspecting your property, let's not forget the people that live across the street from you. And you do have responsibilities to your city and your neighbors. That's really just kind of the bottom line.
So for you, as you go about your day, I am really curious how you go from finding a mysterious either piece of trash or pile of trash and going from there to figuring out kind of the storyline of how did this get here? Who put it here? How can I track them down? What kinds of steps do you take?
Well, there's a lot of knocking and talking. A lot of interviewing people, you know, our 311 and the people that complain to the city, and, you know, all the information that they can give us will help us, you know, if they have any ideas. We obviously can't convict people because somebody said somebody did it, but give us a direction, give us an idea of where we can start knocking and talking, you know, the addresses and any evidence that's in those bags of trash. It always helps us as well. License plate numbers, phone numbers, anything, help us track us down. But, you know, then again, we've got any number of folks that live in our cities who are elderly, handicapped, whatever the case may be. You may have a grandson, a son, a neighbor who's, oh, I'm going to help you out and trying to do the right thing and take your trash for you and get rid of it. And now we find it down, you know, three blocks around the corner. So you got to knock, you got to talk, you got to ask the questions. And with any luck, you know, we find out who dumped it. But at the end of the day, we need to get it up off the streets.
Is there a story that you look back on and just feel incredibly rewarded by just in your illegal dumping investigations time?
Well, man, there's a lot of them actually. Just yesterday, I had caught a dude. Well, I caught him illegally dumping, you know, last week, but I finally tracked him down.
What was he dumping?
He had dumped two old large screen TVs, you know, those big 400 pounders that nobody wants, and a couple of chairs. But he was also a registered sex offender, so, you know, there, I believe a lot of people deserve second chances, but then there are some that don't. So he's gotten what he deserves, so that'll hopefully teach him. But, you know, I'll tell you what, a couple years ago we caught this individual. He pulled up over on 45th and Garfield, and he opened up the side door and threw his dog out.
Whoa.
Puppy dog. Sweetest dog you'd ever met. So we started investigating into that, and myself and Animal Control, we ran the license plates. We figured out, you know, where the guy lived and all that good stuff. Well, the animal control officer at the time continued looking through our pictures. And he noticed a week later that this dog was still in the area. He kept coming back looking for his owner. Unbelievable. Absolutely heartbreaking. So we went and got the dog. We took him. His name was Mojave. And we took him to KC Pet Project. And they, you know, made sure he was as healthy as he can be. Went and talked about Mojave a little bit on the news. He went up to Zona Rosa to be adopted. He was in the store for 30 minutes, and he got adopted. So Mojave's, you know, though it sucks that he got dumped, Mojave's in a much better place. So he was a rewarding story for me.
You know, in this case, the quote-unquote thing being dumped is not a thing at all, but a living creature. But in other cases where, you know, in this case, you put the pet in the custody of people who find homes for pets. But what do you do? What about the actual literal cleanup of, like, piles of tires and
sure,
things like that?
As far as how we approach,
yeah, how do you approach that? Because someone's got to clean up the mess.
Absolutely. Well, one of my most favorite things in the world to do is to make the person to put it there clean it up. You know, and I'll be the first guy to tell him, you know, if you're going to cooperate with me, you're not going to make me run around the block and ask everybody questions just to come back to you. You're going to be pleasant, not assault me like some folks like to do. I will let the prosecutor and the judge know that you were cooperative, you were pleasant, you cleaned up your mess.
So you can't make them do it,
no,
but you
the
can.
The damage is done. They're going to get a ticket. But if they want to help themselves, I'll let the prosecutor know.
Do
that
you,
they
like,
were
kind of, I don't know, lay on, like, the parental talk of, like,
no.
You don't?
No, not at all. If they're going to cooperate with me, we just end up having a very real conversation like you and I. I mean, it's if they're not going to cooperate, then, you know, it's a whole different conversation. But if they're going to cooperate, they go clean it up. But if they're not cooperative, I won't even give them the opportunity to go clean it up. We, you know, the city has folks out there cleaning up trash all day long, so it's just another stop, really.
Are people generally embarrassed when you track them down and let them know, you know, that they've been tossing their trash where it doesn't belong?
Very few.
Really?
Well, very few that have expressed it to me. Let me say that. Because, I mean, they know what they're doing is wrong. It's ridiculous. So, no, I don't think they're embarrassed. They got caught. You know, a lot of them are just like, eh.
Does the city have other jobs that, you know, those of us who don't work for the city might consider unexpected that you think we should be talking about? You're an illegal dumping expert, and we found that fascinating, and it is. Is there some other job of one of your coworkers that you think, yeah, they should be talking to this person?
You know, I'm not sure. You know, us down at Solid Waste, down at Solid Waste, all in one shape or another, get interested in where the trash is and things like that. But, you know, and the folks at Codes Enforcement, they sometimes get a bad rap because people just think, oh, Codes isn't doing anything. Well, that's not true. You have absentee owners that are just refusing to clean their stuff up. It's private property. You just can't go on and do, you know, people have rights here in the land of the home of the free and the brave to own property, and we have to respect that. So it's, you know, it's always nice to hear from one of those folks so they can explain their side of the story. It's not that the city and Codes just isn't doing their job. That's ridiculous. You know, it's that, you know, these aren't your children, you know, that you can force them to clean up their room, or it's not your dog, you rub their face in it, and, you know, it's all going to be okay. It's just not the case.
Alan Ashurst, thank you so much for taking us into your world as Kansas City's illegal dumping expert.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
When we return, KCUR's Central Standard is going to dig into some tough questions about race and politics for music venues. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're talking about a recent controversy at the Riot Room. It's surrounding the Norwegian metal band Taki. They've been called out for using swastikas on stage, and the Westport Music Venue's decision to book and then cancel the band has raised questions about whether venues should take responsibility for the political positions of the bands they put on stage. Let's start by getting the basic story from Aaron Randall, a reporter at the Kansas City Star. Aaron, can you give us the basic timeline of events as they unfolded?
Sure. About a few weeks ago, well, for some months, obviously, Taki had been, they had been scheduled to perform at the Riot Room. And I'm not quite sure how he came upon this knowledge, but the very well-known hip-hop room recording artist, Talib Kweli, he kind of went on a mini Twitter rant on social media platform, just kind of saying that he did not want to perform there because, or he was going to cancel his show because he felt that the Riot Room had not followed the steps of other venues in like New York and Chicago, who, after finding out about certain questionable behavior by Taki, that some called Nazi sympathizing and white nationalist, these other venues had kind of canceled and severed ties with Taki, and the Riot Room had not. And when Talib Kweli found that out, he kind of equated that with the Riot Room not enforcing, but sympathizing with racism and white nationalism.
Yeah, I think his statement was a band that books a racist band is race, or a venue, excuse me, that books a racist band is racist.
Right.
It's a very bold statement. I want to back up just a little bit because you said that, you know, the Taki has been, that some have called their behavior in the past Nazi sympathizing or white nationalist. Mm-hmm. When you say some have called, can you explain a little bit why you're putting it that way?
I say that because just journalistically, I try not to work in absolutes all the time. And I'm sure the guests could speak a little bit more to, you know, the genre of black metal. But they have actually, they've donned Nazi symbolism like the Iron Cross. And one of the front runners has worn a swastika. They've worn anti-Islamic symbology symbols on their person. They have some anti-Christian and anti-religious lyrics, but they themselves have disavowed that they are Nazis or white nationalists because in their mind, the way I understand it, metal is very misanthropic and anti-religion, really kind of everything almost. So in their mind, they're not really singling out any specific people or belief as better or worse. They just kind of don't like everything. So their kind of position was, I'm not anti-Nazi. I'm kind of anti-everything. You guys are just honing in on the Nazism and, you know, the religious aspect.
So we're going to get some insight into the black metal genre in a minute. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, you know, Talib Kweli is a big deal. So when he called out not just the band, Taki, but also the Riot Room for booking the band, that had implications. I mean, this story's been written up by Billboard, by Newsweek.
Yeah.
A local music show has become big news beyond Kansas City.
Absolutely. I think that it's we have to talk about this conversation in the context of, you know, timing and cultural cognizance, right? And I just think that where we are today in America's political and social climate, that these are really hot button issues, you know, things that touch on oppression and marginalized people and symbols that have a history of hurting people. And I think that in this climate, an artist like Talib Kweli, who has always been outspoken on social and human issues and rights, you know, when he takes to a platform like that and he holds these places, these people or these organizations or institutions to the fire, then people are going to take notice and they're going to talk about it.
Well, I want to bring in another guest. Mike Russo is one of my coworkers here at KCUR. He used to co-own a record label, Record Machine, and he's a fan of the black metal genres. Mike, okay, before we get your story, I want to give you a chance to respond to what Aaron's just said in his description of black metal and its, I don't know, its contrarian nature, maybe?
Well, I think he's completely correct so far in his description of it. I think that in some ways, and this was where I found myself confused in this scenario, was black metal is kind of a place, what I thought to be for misfits, the outcasts. And then there's this other line where it's what I've been calling debased nihilism, where there's kind of this throwing out of the rules and trying to get stuff that's for reactions. And I think that's what Taki found themselves doing. I wasn't familiar with the band before this controversy happened, but I think there's repercussions for that type of lifestyle, trying to get a reaction. In some ways,
you'll get one.
Yeah, they got what they wanted, right? You don't get to don a swastika and also get to go on tour, I think. Sometimes those things might be mutually exclusive.
Well, so Mike, how did this whole story unfold for you?
So I was a fan of the supporting act King Dude. And it appeared on my Facebook that they were coming to town, like through one of those apps, like Band Is in Town or something like that. And so I was planning on going. It's a band that I've always wanted to see for a while. And around the same time that they were canceling other shows, he said, I'm going to drop off this tour. It appears that the band that I'm supporting has been engaged in previous racist behavior, and I don't want to be on that. And so I honestly was embarrassed that I'd even clicked interested on this show without doing the proper research of a band I wasn't familiar with just because I was a fan of a supporting act.
So you felt some guilt by association, not as a venue owner, not even as someone who bought tickets to the show, just as a music fan who clicked interested based on not even the band in question on Facebook.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think that Talib's actions even held a good fire to me of, like, if I'm going to just do a simple act of click interested, I should go ahead and research all of the bands that I'm, like, somewhat digitally endorsing.
That's really interesting. Okay, we've heard from Mike and we've heard from Aaron. I want to bring in one more guest right now. Let's talk to a rapper here in town, Kemet the Phantom. Kemet, tell us how you experienced the Riot Room story.
Well, I first heard about it on Facebook and on Twitter because I follow Talib Kweli, and Talib is very active on Twitter. And so basically when I saw this come up on my feed, I was like, oh, crap, this is not good. you know, and I had never
Why did you feel that way about it? I mean, did you have some, I don't know, protectiveness of Kansas City's reputation, of the Riot Room?
You know, honestly, like, I just felt like it was just a bad look overall because of the fact that, you know, it was unfortunate to see Riot Room not do their due diligence or overlook what they discovered when they were in the due diligence process. And I thought that was something that I even questioned if I should continue to play there. And I, you know, said the same question to my band as well. And so I just continued to dig deeper into the subject. And, you know, it brought up other questions as well, as like, do venues have this responsibility? Should they be the ones to take this on? Or at the end of the day, they're a private business. So, like, you know. Where should they go?
Yeah, I mean, what kinds of conclusions did you come to in asking that question?
I mean, I feel like if Riot Room were to be the ones to book a band like this, you know, they obviously, if they haven't heard about their history, they are, you know, a little bit negligent. And so I think they must have been aware of the ramifications that would have happened at the show going on. And, you know, given the history of, you know, the outbreaks and outcries from the symbolisms that Taki has put out there, I mean, I feel like it's very interesting that Riot Room would continue to book that when other venues across the country have canceled.
Okay, listeners, what do you think? Do music venues and maybe even music fans have some accountability to know about and answer for the politics of bands? Where does that responsibility begin and end? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also tweet us. We are at KCURCST. Let's talk about the venue, because the Riot Room, I mean, Aaron Randall, you wrote an article in The Star a while back about the reluctance of many venues to book shows they know are going to draw a black crowd. And you noted the Riot Room is an exception to that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to be fair, none of us know exactly at this point what happened in this specific instance, but I do stand by that. I talk to many musicians, and I know even Kim has performed, like he's mentioned a lot of times. The Riot Room is one of the most diverse booking venues, I believe, in the city. And I can understand how, for some context, like the swastika incident that happened in 2007, I believe, with Taki. And a lot of their more, I should say, provocative instances have happened quite some time ago. So I can understand how there could be a lapse in missing that information. I honestly do. You know, sometimes booking agents, maybe if you Google Taki, we don't know now, but if you Google Taki 2 weeks ago, do we know the first thing that comes up on the Google page is anything about Nazism? You know, I mean, how do we know that? And I do believe, just seeing how culturally cognizant and how just open to protecting their constituency and their patrons and their fans, the Riot Room has been in the past, it makes it easier for me to kind of believe this was an honest misstep.
Kemet, yeah. Talk to me about that too. I mean, I wonder if maybe the audience, though, is more likely to feel sort of targeted by those kinds of antics or feel, you know, that's part of that too, right?
Definitely. Well, I think the same reason why the Riot Room has been a place that has allowed hip hop music to take hold there is the same reason why they would, you know, book Taki. Just being open and not really caring about, just basically being open to artistic expression, whether that's acceptable or not. I mean, Riot Room also
whether
books,
you agree with it or not.
Yeah, Riot Room books Big Frida, who is, a New Orleans bounce music. I mean, she's got strippers on the stage. I mean, like, I've seen all kind of crazy stuff happen at Riot Room. There's a reason it's called the Riot Room, you know? And so it doesn't surprise me that this has happened, but it is unfortunate.
So it's interesting. I feel like you're saying, though, that it's possible that the same kind of philosophy that makes the Riot Room really open to diverse bands in a way that you find commendable might be the same reason why they could have been open
that's
to this
right.
band.
Totally. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
I do think that there is a line between exclusionary behavior and racism and just being provocative or even talking about things that might not be family friendly. And I think that is the line that Taki crossed. And that's why it, I don't know, yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and hear from our listeners on this bigger question of whether a venue has a responsibility for the politics of the bands they book, for knowing those politics and maybe standing by them if they're going to book them, or not. 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Jack in Shawnee. Hi, Jack.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. If it's a Nazi symbol, that's a red line. In my view, we fought World War II against the Nazis. I believe in free speech, but there are limits on free speech. I believe the Riot Room should pay the penalty, and we should deny it business. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you, Jack. He has a very straightforward take on what I think a lot of people are seeing as a pretty complicated issue.
Yeah, It brings to mind the concept, I believe it was a philosopher, Karl Popper, who called it the paradox of tolerance, or the tolerance paradox. It's kind of talking about, you know, in a way, in order to maintain tolerance, you have to sometime be intolerant, right? Because if you have to draw those lines, like the gentleman just said, because sometimes if you allow those who are openly intolerant, like Taki, right, who kind of, they literally have been quoted as saying they are built upon provocation and evil, right? If you allow the intolerant to enter into these spaces where tolerance is supposed to be the status quo, they run the risk of dominating the tolerant, right? And then maybe even erasing the tolerant. So you have to use, you know, some judgment. And, you know, and this is always going to be a dicey situation about freedom of speech, you know, because I think this, for me, reminds me of like Cop Killer with Ice-T in the 80s, or, you know, other songs to the 2 Live Crew in the 90s about obscenity. Like, when do we know, like, when do we draw the line? And I think that when there are symbols that are tied very, very clearly to destruction and to oppression and to hurt, like a swastika, that's when we have to begin to take more serious action and think deeper about it.
Well, and as far as freedom of speech goes, I don't know that anyone's talking about like government action. You know, I feel like boycotting someone is within the realm of free speech.
And that's interesting, right? Because I don't know about you guys, but when I've seen it, I've been following this on the internet. A lot of people, even Taki themselves in a statement, have called this an attack on free speech, which is kind of ironic, right? Because censorship, in a way, in this situation, because free speech protects an expression, right? We can't say Taki can't make the music, but we absolutely can protest venues from, you know, and saying we don't want to hear you. And in a way, that is censorship, because it's kind of like the population getting a venue to close its doors. But ironically, that censorship is a part of the freedom to assemble. And therefore, it's kind of like it's informed by the freedom of speech, you know. So it's kind of interesting how this all kind of is a circle in this situation.
Let's talk to James in Olathe. Hi, James.
Hi. And this could be a really long conversation. I just wanted to bring up a couple of things. I'll try to be quick. One, I think Tolkien is an ugly baby to defend, but I do think they are kind of getting a raw deal on the show at the moment. That's one thing I'd like to
wait.
What? Like to clarify.
Can you say explain
think,
that? Why do you think they're getting a raw deal?
Well, I think some of the factual background is maybe not hasn't been super clear on the show. The swastika incident happened one time. It happened in 2007 in Essen, Germany, where the vocalist came out on stage bare-chested with a swastika on his chest. He's never done it again. He's apologized for it. And, you know, earlier you were kind of, someone on the show was saying that the intent was more of an anti-religious thing, and that's true. It shouldn't be viewed as a racist symbol. It should be viewed more as a, for Tolkien and for many black metal bands, if they're going to use something like the swastika, it's going to be seen as a neo-pagan symbol. Because it originally comes out of pagan cultures, including Hindu culture.
You know, James, can I ask you a question, though, about that? And this is just genuine curiosity on my part. Do you think that who you are might shape how you see a symbol like a swastika, no matter what the intent is? I mean, because for me as a Jewish person, for example, like, you know, a swastika has a threat that comes with it. No, you know what
I
mean?
I agree. It definitely has a lot of heavy weight to it, a lot of negative, evil weight to it. I agree. I mean, we've seen other artists do this, right? We saw Sid Vicious of the Sex Pistols wear a T-shirt with a swastika on it. Susie of Susie and the Banshees wore a Nazi armband. I've never heard anybody claim they were Nazis or racist because of things like that. That's just one thing I'd like to.
Yeah.
It would take too long to get into it on this show.
Well, no, and
but I do think to really understand where Tolkien is coming from or another band like them, is you really have to have a pretty good understanding of black metal, and I don't think it's something you can get in 20 minutes. And on the other hand, the other thing that's also bad is there is a branch of black metal that is known as NSBM, National Socialist Black Metal. It mainly comes out of the former Soviet bloc countries for some reason. those bands are openly racist, openly neo-Nazi, but, and they're not trying to hide it. There's even labels, or at least one label that I know of, that only promotes and produces that type of black metal. So there's something out there that's bad, very bad. I don't think Tokay falls in that category. They've tried to explain that. That's one thing I wanted to say. The other thing that didn't come up in this conversation, unless I missed it while I was talking to your producer, is that I think the thing that really led to the show being shut down, by the way, Tokay's played at the Right Room two other times. So they've been there before. But there was a local activist organization that called themselves the Kansas City Revolutionary Collective. And on their WordPress blog, they described themselves as a Maoist activist organization or something like that. Anyway, they put up an event page on Facebook, and they were inviting people to show up to the show, the Tokay show, with clubs and pepper spray, and to give Tokay fans something to be afraid of. All right.
Did you see this yourself or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah, and I even reported to Facebook, and they, and I know several other people did. And at first they weren't sure about it, but just last Friday, Facebook messaged me and told me that not only did they take down the event page, but they killed the organization's whole Facebook page.
Okay, James. James, I'm going to get some response to a few of the things you said. We can't respond to all of it, but Mike Russo, you know, he's shared some information about black metal, and I wonder if you want to respond to any of what he said about the genre itself.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, I actually disagree. I think Aaron's done a pretty good job of setting up an informed timeline of what happened. So I don't know that we've missed that. We did miss the fact that when Tokay did have a swastika on, that they responded with anti-Muslim comments after being called out after that. So they don't necessarily display a pattern of apologizing or trying to make good on their wrongs, right? As far as black metal, the genre goes, yes, it is probably anti-establishment and anti-religion, but in a way that is sometimes even spiritual for people, right? Or sometimes inclusive. When it goes into those other areas of black metal, those aren't things that are commonly always associated with black metal. Provocatism, it has its limits in a lot of the genre, I would say.
So for you, you know, when you think about like this comment that they only did it one time, does that matter when it's a swastika?
No. I think that there are some things that, yeah, and you kind of spoke on that. I can't elaborate more than just no. Having a swastika in public is probably an unacceptable behavior.
You know, Jeremy tweets us along those same lines. Anyone who offers a platform for Nazis is at minimum a fellow traveler. Riot Room isn't off the hook just because they canceled the Nazi band. They should be held accountable for offering them space in the first place. Kemet, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I just think that there's just a lot of, I mean, you got to be willing to accept the public outcry for something like this. And, you know, I have never really experienced any type of discrimination from Riot Room, and I didn't really see that they could do that to, you know, that they would do that to anyone else. But I do feel like you're right. I mean, Riot Room is not off the hook for, you know, for something like this. And it's tough being a musician, you know, not having a venue. But at the end of the day, it's like, what do you support?
So we're going to get into the musicians' responsibilities in a minute. Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in on this question of whether you hold venues responsible for the questionable politics of their bands. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm talking with rapper Kemet the Phantom, black metal fan Mike Russo, and Kansas City Stars Aaron Randall about a recent controversy involving a local music venue. They booked a Norwegian band that's been accused of Nazi sympathies, and then they canceled that band. And when a major hip-hop artist called them out, saying that a venue that books a racist band is racist, it became national, maybe even international news. But do you agree with that statement, that a venue that books a racist band is racist? 816-235-2888. And Kemet, you were saying that this was tough for you and your fellow musicians in your band, just thinking about what your responsibility is.
Right, yeah. I mean, we all have responsibility, and to think that we shouldn't have any responsibility is a privilege that most of us don't possess. The thing for me, just being a black man, like, I expect, you know, almost everybody to be a little bit insensitive when it comes to, or not insensitive, but just maybe a little ignorant sometimes when it comes to cultural sensitivities.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No.
And so, you know, I kind of give people one chance, you know, it's like, if you are this way, then come back with something that's better. But if you go, if you consistently don't show any improvement in your perspective, then that's when we have a problem. And so, you know, as far as Riot Room is concerned and most of my band, that's kind of where we sat. You know, it's unfortunate and it's ridiculous. And but at the end of the day.
So wait, did you ask yourselves, like, should we continue performing at this venue?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We have a Facebook group in there. In the Facebook group, I said, should we continue to play at Riot Room? And, you know, most of my band, which are majority African-American, we did say that, you know, obviously this is like unforgivable for most of what Taki is and what they're about. However, we do know, kind of what I touched on earlier, that the same reason why Riot Room books us is the same reason why they'd probably book somebody like that. And so we have felt that because of how hip-hop does not have a home in Kansas City, it does not have a home in Kansas City, and Riot Room has been a venue to accept that, what we do, you know, we're willing to give them a second chance.
Let's talk to another caller. We've got Jason with us in Blue Springs. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
What can you share with us?
Well, I think that holding a venue responsible for the artistic and political views of the performers is I think it's unfair. I don't think it really applies in this case. I mean, those artists, and it sounds like this particular group espouse things that I would disagree with vehemently, but you know, if you happen to be an artist that expresses things that are misogynistic or that are anti-establishment, does that make the venue anti-establishment or misogynistic? If we draw a line in certain areas, I don't know if this artist was trying to incite violence, but clearly they had some things that would be symbolic of hate. But again, that doesn't necessarily make the venue, who apparently tries to be open to different artistic styles and expressions, shouldn't make them responsible for what the artist has to say or what the artist does.
All right, let's get some response to that.
Can we, and also I think we need to maybe acknowledge the issue of capitalism and its role in this, right? Like, sure, they can book the band. Again, freedom of speech says that we can give space as a, you know, Riot Room to people to express their opinions, which for Taki may be anti-Semitism or anti-what may have you. But they also can, I think that a big part of this conversation is the Riot Room realizing that there was a threat possibly of violence or protest, or that there could have been some money ramifications here, right? Like, do we lose a portion of our fan base? Do we now struggle to fill our venue for further concerts? And that affects the bottom dollar. Do we even want to, you know, sure, we can say we'll take on these protesters when they get here, but that means hiring more security. Is that a financial risk we want to take? I think that was absolutely a part of the decision-making here with the Riot Room, because in the end of the day, it is a business, and capitalism at the end of the day in this country rules.
And that's part of where individuals can sometimes express themselves, depending on how many dollars they have.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that plays a huge part. I mean, and, you know, why wouldn't it when we're in a financial system the way we are? But like I say earlier, you know, if you're going to book somebody that has this type of history, you've got to be ready and prepared to experience these type of public occurrences. And I'm not sure if I didn't personally see an apology or any type of acknowledgement from Riot Room, except for the withdrawal of that particular show. And that was after maybe 3 days of crazy stuff happening on Twitter and Facebook in these conversations.
What is there a kind of statement that could make a difference to you as a music fan, Mike?
Well, so Riot Room, I think to Kemet's point, they did eventually cancel the show and state that they want their venue to be a safe place for people and a freedom of expression. So I think they tried to right their wrongs. The debatable part would be, did they do it too late? And I think as Aaron brought up, did they do it because of financial implications? I'm not saying either way, but I do think they tried to at least say, we want to be a safe place.
Let's talk to Craig in Kansas City. Hi, Craig.
Hello.
Hi, what do you want to add?
Well, I mean, I've been listening only for a short while, and I am an older man, so I come from a time where they shut down my music, Dead Kennedys, Black Flag, 7 Seconds, and we had to go to a place out in the middle of Kansas.
The outhouse.
Cornfield, listen to it, right.
And so you're talking about punk music.
Right, but at the time, they were saying things. And even some of the bands were saying things that borderline anti-Semitic and some of the nasty things that were going on. But we embraced it all. And I didn't agree with everything that every band said. But the bottom line is, I don't think the venue has much responsibility. I think they have to pay the price for who they bring in. But, I mean, there are plenty of hip-hop acts that say things about women that are offensive to me and that I think every woman in this country could protest about. So I just don't like the line drawing. I think that if we're going to have art, we need to let art be art. And if you don't want to see it, don't come see it. But certainly don't blame the gallery or the place where it's being shown.
So let me make sure I understand this. Is your position that the venue should pay the financial price of people not coming to see the show or whatever, but that the larger implication that the venue is racist is maybe unfair?
I think that's totally unfair. I think that if people don't want to come, then don't come. And honestly, by making this a national and maybe international story, they've probably done more good for the Riot Room than they've actually done bad. But that's kind of maybe a different show.
Yeah. Well, Craig. Thank you. I want to get response. Kemet, talk to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just it comes down to, like, how much you want to invest in this type of controversy. Like, no one is saying we should pass laws to where Riot Room should no longer book people like this. I think, just as we were talking about freedom of speech, we can say that Riot Room is racist. I'm not saying that personally, but we can say that. And just as they can also book, you know, Taki. And so I think it's just a matter of opinion and perspective and how much Riot Room is willing to go, you know, if they really want to be open and inviting, how much are they willing to support every side of the argument?
I'm also curious about just this idea that maybe there was a time when music that was considered politically progressive or music that people thought pushed some kind of envelope often did include things that maybe people didn't agree with one another, but maybe that was more okay back then or something. I mean, if as a black man, is that comfortable for you?
I mean, as a black man, it's like, I always have to tiptoe around a lot of things, especially being a rapper. And so I just think that more people are becoming aware of some of these nuances in our sensitivities. And so we definitely need to make sure that we are doing our part to make sure that everybody feels warm and welcome in a more divisive time.
Well, our time is up. Thank you so much to everyone who participated in this conversation. Aaron Randall, Kemet Coleman, Mike Russo, this has been super interesting. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this conversation or anything you might have missed on this show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And keep talking to us on Twitter. We are at @KCURCST. Tomorrow we'll have a food show, Peruvian cuisine and other South American foods, plus the latest restaurant news, openings, closings, buzzworthy developments. That's tomorrow at 10. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.